There we go. So, those outside who want to come in, those inside who want to go out, you are most welcome to get yourself ready for this evening's talk about something or other. I know it's quite warm outside today, so some people prefer sitting outside on the bench over there. It's good air and it's not too cold this evening. And there's plenty of places in the front. These are the best seats in the house. If there was a concert by Beyonce, they'd be as close as they possibly can. If there was a concert by Beyonce, she wouldn't be here yet, apparently. She's always a couple of hours late, at least, on principle. Very good. Okay. Again, as usual, just these talks, you don't plan, you don't write them out, you don't just expect what you're going to even say. You start somewhere and see where the talk goes, which makes it very interesting. And of course, usually it's affected by what has happened to me or what I've come across in the last few days. And I just already told you that I've just returned from a teaching tour in Hong Kong. And just messing about with teaching in all sorts of places. And there was a few people who I met over there. They were very strong supporters of the Buddhist group. You see them over in the Maylands Temple. And actually, I think it's actually next week, next weekend, they're having their big Buddha's birthday celebration in center of town, Fo Kwang Shan. And they were telling me that their teacher, very famous in Taiwan, was trying to make Buddhism more relevant to ordinary people, to try and take these teachings out of your heads, into your hearts, so they're not just theories, but things which actually work in your daily life. And they call that humanistic Buddhism, making it down to earth as humans. And they got a very good point there, because too often, you know, when you come across a great teaching like Buddhism, it becomes so intellectual, so hard to understand. And unfortunately, that many people, they keep on saying that if they understand it, it can't be profound. But if it's something you can't understand at all, it sounds good, but it's total gobbledygook. You go outside and said, wow, that was deep. But first of all, even the deepest teachings, the one which has the most meaning, you should be able to explain it in a way which everyone can understand. So if anything which is said by the monks and nuns here is simple to understand, never assume that it's not profound. And I recall one of my favorite quotes from the great German quantum physicist Werner Heisenberg. And I like this quote because something like quantum physics has got the reputation of being so profound and so deep that many people, even Albert Einstein, didn't really understand it. So what hope is there for us? But this guy Heisenberg, who was one of the leaders in that field, he was quoted as saying that if you know what you're talking about, if you have a deep understanding of the subject, then you will be able to explain it to the person serving you beer in the pub. In other words, the level of your understanding is equivalent to your ability to transfer that understanding to others. So just because it's intelligible, that you can understand it, does not mean it's not profound. That's why bringing it down to people's levels is the art of understanding it for yourself so you could teach it to others. But, yeah, I've been doing that. We've been doing that in this temple for many, many years, which is one of the reasons why there's so many people listening on YouTube. But I wanted to take it another step. From intellectual Buddhism to humanistic Buddhism, and to take it to the next step of humoristic Buddhism. Which makes it the next step closer to people's hearts. Because life is funny. It's joyful. People do all sorts of stupid things in life. If you don't make a mistake and don't do something stupid, do something stupid on purpose this weekend. Because that is the reality of human beings. So I like to make it humoristic Buddhism. Bringing in that fun and joy into a part where people take it far too serious. Serious? And so many people think that, you know, because I was giving talks on the last talk, one of the last talks I gave was talking on the subject of dementia. And now that is serious stuff. And my own mother passed away with dementia 3 years. She didn't even know who I was. I thought when I went to visit her, you know, in England, there's not many people look like me. Surely I'm a dead giveaway. I'm your son. Look at me. Bald head, brown robe. But she still didn't remember me. But my grandma also had dementia. And when I went to visit her, I went to visit her with my brother. My brother, really good guy, he was going to visit every week. And I just maybe once every 2 or 3 years managed to get away from Australia and go to England, find a little time to visit my family. And only once every 3 or 4 years I managed to get out there. And when I went into this home for people with dementia, my grandma looked up and said, my lay name was Peter. She said, "Hi Peter, how have you been?" And my brother came in next, and she said, "Who are you?" My brother was really upset. "You younger brother, you only come once every 3 years. She knows who you are. I come every week, and she doesn't know who I am." But, you know, that's being able to laugh at what, for many people, is extremely sad. Why is it sad? Who are you sad for? When someone has dementia, you're sad for yourself. You don't like it. What about the person who has dementia? How are they? My mum was actually quite happy. Imagine, no worries, no anxieties, no fears for the future, because you couldn't think that far. For her, you know, she was at peace, having a good time. And sometimes in that dementia talk, I thought, my goodness, what you hear here in this temple here, are we encouraging you to get dementia? How many times I say, let go of the past, don't worry about the past. Sometimes one of the symptoms of dementia is being socially withdrawn. And I encourage you to go on retreats and don't talk to each other. You can't think very much. And I tell you, stop thinking. I may be a main cause of dementia. But actually, no. Okay, look, I'm making it fun. Because that talk I gave last night in Singapore on dementia, that was, for many people, very serious because they were afraid. Like many people are afraid. I think it's like 1 in 10 people over 65 are already suffering from dementia. They may not be diagnosed yet. So how many people over 65? 65 and over are there here? Me, a few others. So according to statistics, and all of you, and a few of you haven't put your hands up, Dennis. So you may have dementia. Averages, 1 in 10. So we've got more than 10 people here, so who is it? Now, one of the reasons why we have the humoristic Buddhism is because when you do laugh, even, straight away that gives you a positive mind. It takes away the fear, the weight, the anxieties. You know, just a bit of laughter is an incredibly positive attitude. So when I talk like that, I am actually stopping dementia, engaging you in this world, seeing the past as something you can laugh at, rather you get negative about, which is all my happy memories. Those are the memories of fun, joy, laughter. Honestly, the only people who don't laugh, the only two types of people I've seen who don't laugh are terrorists and dead people. So if you're not laughing, which one are you? Even, so you give it like a serious talk like that on dementia, and I was a bit concerned how far I could go, you know, with actually just making people laugh at something for most people is so terrifying, and they say it's so sad to see someone who was in full control of their faculties, could come and go, and they knew where they lived. But I always tend to see the positive in anything. That's my training as a Buddhist monk, not seeing the negative. And it's amazing what you can see. And one of those stories from when my mother had dementia, when I went to visit her in a really, really caring facility. It had to be locked, because your mother would go wandering around, she wouldn't know where she was. But there was a locked ward, but as soon as I went in with my brother, the first thing my brother said when she saw my mother, that's not the dress I bought for her. Because my brother would supply, you know, all the clothes and other stuff. That was his responsibility. Very caring. And then he caught himself and laughed. He said, "Oh, sorry. But she always does this. I buy her dresses. I know what I bought her. And I go and visit her and she's wearing somebody else's dress." Because that's what happens in such a ward. When you don't have any short-term memory, you don't actually remember what's yours and what's somebody else's. So they go in each other's rooms, because they don't know which room is theirs, and they see a nice dress, and they just put it on. So yeah, my mother was wearing somebody else's dress, but somebody else was wearing my mother's dress. It's what we try and encourage in Buddhism. Sharing. No ownership. Not me, not mine, not herself. So you see that much of what I encourage is not ownership. Amazing, what a wonderful world it would be when we just share everything. When we don't have any ideas of ownership. When it's enough for everybody. Honestly, ladies, how many dresses have you got in your wardrobe? Imagine how many dresses you could wear if you could go into other people's wardrobes. And they can go into yours. I mean, that would really cripple the economy, the dress economy, because, you know, you wouldn't need so many because you've got more to use. Your supply is extended enormously with sharing. But that gives you a new attitude, another way of looking at things. So anything which people say, "Oh, it's so sad. Why is it so sad?" Look again. Because a lot of times that we just follow like sheep, what other people say. We learn our cultural responses by following others, without really being aware and using our wisdom to actually say, is this really so such a bad thing? So you look at it. Of course there are some people who do sort of suffer with dementia. But many people, like, it was one of the things which I mentioned last night, and which there was a head of one of the a doctor who specialises in that area, and also in palliative care. You know, he said, "Yeah, that's so true," in his experience and my experience as well. If you are an easygoing person, a kind person, a selfless person, you know, is really positive in your main part of your life, if dementia does hit, yeah, you cannot think or remember as well as you did before. Your intellectual capabilities are decreased, and your ability to articulate, to speak, is decreased. But those underlying emotions, they carry through. My mother was pretty easygoing. She was a very easy patient to look after, simply because, you know, she wasn't into complaining. You know, she was, "Oh, this is good enough. Yeah, it's okay." And because those characters had been characteristics, if you like, those character traits had been developed in the major part of her life, yeah, she didn't remember who was who and what to say. But the deeper part of her brain, no, remember just how to behave. And that was a fascinating little insight, that what you learn here by doing some meditation, what you learn by listening to these talks, what you learn by hanging out with monks and nuns, because they do influence you, just hanging out with them, talking to them, having their positive energy, that actually gives you that character trait of positivity and kindness and gentleness that is not forgotten in dementia. That continues on. If you're a cranky old boss now, if you get dementia, you'll be such a pain in the ass to look after. A difficult patient. Interestingly. And you know, it's those character traits also in Buddhism which go over into your next life. Things which don't get lost. Yeah, all your knowledge, all the stuff you spend so much time remembering at school, all the stuff which you learn intellectually, that gets lost. Some of that is already getting lost in me. All the stuff I work so hard for, learning in theoretical physics at Cambridge, learning it, remembering it, being examined in it, a lot of that is now gone. You know why? It's like every now and again the computer says, you've got too much rubbish on your computer, which slows down the processing of your emails. Delete. And so I happily delete that. And that's what you do in your brain as well. You delete. I am very good with the delete button. That's one of the first real buttons I learnt on a computer. That was my favourite one. Because that is actually my life. I delete. That's my job. So you delete all your past. What do you want to keep carrying that around for? But for me, it's a bit of a problem, because every now and again, I'm supposed to remember things. Especially people's names. And that is just one of the big bummers of being a monk, is that a lot of time, it's absolutely crazy, it's really illogical. You go to Hong Kong, and someone comes up, "Oh, I saw you here, I saw you at a talk 5 years ago. Do you remember me?" 5 years ago! There's 1,000 talks have happened since then. And there was a couple of hundred people, 600 people at the talk last time. "Of course I don't remember you." And they get really offended. It's really nasty when you don't remember people. So of course you know my trick now. When somebody comes up and they say, "Do you remember me?" And I can't lie. And so I say, "Ah, you're the person whose name I keep forgetting." It's a nice way out of a very difficult situation. Then I don't get offended, but I'm still telling the truth. But the most important thing is I've learned how to not have anxiety or fear for the future. Again, just like demented people, that's why you can have fun in really difficult situations. You know, telling jokes at funerals. And I started that off 30 years ago, when my predecessor, Ajahn Chakro, you know, at that time he took all the best gigs, and I took the leftovers. Now I take all the best gigs, and I give the other monks the second class gig. No, pretty fair. But I was a funeral monk. I love telling funeral stories. It's so funny. People think it's so sad at a funeral, but it's not. Oh, in this one case, I was doing a funeral over in Subiaco, in Rockaby Road. There's a funeral parlour down the bottom of Rockaby Road. And it was one of the, it was a Chinese young man. One of his parents died. And they asked me, please, can you come and do the funeral for us? It's Buddhist. And so I went there, and, you know, people were very sad. You know, someone in their family had died. And I had to, you know, be the MC and do the chanting and doing everything. And as I went up to do the to welcome everybody, I said, we're here to do the Buddhist funeral rites for the mother of my disciple here who passed away tragically, and it's a great loss. We're going to do it in a positive way. And as I was starting off my opening speech, this elderly woman in the front stood up and interrupted me. She said, it's not me who's dead, my husband, he's the guy who died. I had a 50-50 chance and I blew it, I got it wrong. I knew it was one of the parents, it wasn't actually clear which one it was. That was one of the best funerals I did, it was so much fun. You couldn't take it serious after that. So even putting humour into a funeral, what actually that does is people see it in a different way. Instead of seeing it sad, depressing, oh my goodness, do you want people to cry and feel sad and depressed when you die? At your funeral? What type of funeral do you want? I remember this guy, I mentioned him, I was in Hong Kong. I forget who his name was now, but he had a really good idea. Do things different. Don't always be like a sheep doing what other people do. And he had good reason for this. You know, he was terminal, he was going to die soon. But he thought, why is it that you have to have your funeral after you die? He said, no, I'm going to pay for it. So I'm going to do my funeral before I die. What a great idea. Get it out of the way. And you know at funerals, people always say these amazing, wonderful things about you. They never say it about you when you're alive. That's one of those jokes I read a long time ago. You know, the wife, the widow, was at the funeral of her husband with her kids, and the priest was actually at the front there, just like priests usually say, it's very sad, but this was a wonderful guy, a loving husband, a great, loving, caring father. And the wife told one of her sons, said, can you go up to the top there, make sure that's your father actually in the coffin? Because it doesn't sound like him. So, when they do say nice things about you, isn't it just a shame you're not there to enjoy it? To hear it? So, when they say these amazing things which you never really expect when you're alive, he said, no, I am going to have my funeral before I die so I can hear all the wonderful things people say about me. That sort of makes sense. And also he said, you know, I'm going to die soon, I've got a will. I want to actually see who actually comes. So I can adjust my will afterwards. which is another good thing to do. And you know that also what happens, it's happened here before. Now you may be a Buddhist. You come here, you know, you even sign up, you're a member of our Buddhist society, but you know, one of your children, you know, is a Christian. And they get power of attorney over you. So they say, no, I'm going to give you a Christian funeral. But Mum was a Buddhist. I don't care. She's getting a Christian funeral. That's happened here. And when you're dead, you can't do anything. But if you're alive, you can. So if you have your funeral before you die, then you can make sure you've still got power of attorney because you're still alive. So you can decide what type of funeral you want. So there's many advantages that way. And so there can be a lot of happiness at a service like that. Because that's how many people want to be remembered by. So you're actually changing people's perceptions, making it humoristic, but also quite deep. You all know, I keep telling this, but it fits in on this particular part. Funeral services should be like concerts. Concerts always have an ending. And I always remember all those beautiful concerts I went to. I never cried after a great concert, even though I knew it was ending. I wouldn't hear that great music again. I felt inspired, even though it ended. Why do endings always have to be felt with grief that it's over? Grief is a culturally added response to endings. To me, an ending is like the ending of a day here in Western Australia. The beautiful sunsets over the Indian Ocean. Best time of the day, they're gorgeous. But have you ever noticed, if it is a cloudless night, a cloudless day, if there's no bushfires, there's no ash or dirt in the sky, then these sunsets aren't as beautiful. Have a few clouds, especially clouds, not too many, but a few. And they just spread out the golden light into reds and crimsons. And sometimes it's like the sea is on fire at the sunset. It's beautiful. But if the sky is perfect, with no blemishes, no clouds, no dust, it's never as attractive. Just like you. If you're too perfect, you're not beautiful. You got a few scars, a few clouds, a few marks, a bit of dust. Then you're beautiful. I always like this because people got the crazy idea of perfection. Has to be perfect. Life is not like that. If life was perfect, we'd have no opportunity for jokes. I am not perfect. I get into trouble for jokes. I'm not sure if I said this 2 weeks ago, but I said this several times in Hong Kong. It's Easter coming up soon. It's only in 2 weeks. So this husband was asked by his wife, "What are you doing for Easter, darling?" And he said, "I'm doing a Jesus over Easter. I'm disappearing on Friday. I'll come back again on Sunday." And his wife, not to be outdone, "Okay, if you're doing a Jesus, I'm going to do a Mary. When you come back on Monday, I'll be pregnant and you would not have touched me." Please, all my Christian friends, it's not bagging Christianity, it just happens to be the joke, okay, so please don't excommunicate me or burn me in a stake or come with an inquisition this evening and take me away. But isn't it wonderful we can put humour into something which for many people was serious? And if it's serious, where is the love and the kind? Have you ever known how close love and laugh is actually as words? I don't know the etymology, but it should be very close together. Laugh, love, live, so close together. They sound close together. And so they should be. If you're not laughing, you're not living. And look, you guys in relationships, you women in relationships, when there's no laughter in your marriage, the love is going as well. Laughing, loving, living. When there is no laughter, there's usually shouting. I don't know if I told this last time, I forget now. I know, when you actually hear talks about dementia, you take it in. You empathize so much, you know, become a little bit demented. So anyway, that was the, probably did 2 weeks ago, about why is it that people shout at each other? You know, there's the old story that in the first year of marriage, the wife listens to the husband. In the second year of marriage, the husband listens to the wife. In the third year of marriage, the neighbours listen to both of you. Why are you laughing? Because there's some truth in it, isn't there? But why is it we have to argue so loud the neighbours can hear us? And that is, this another monk told me this story, a very wise little saying, is because when you are far apart, emotionally, of course you have to shout to be listened to. Just like if you're standing at the other side of this temple, you have to shout to be heard, because you're distant from one another. But when you're close to one another, when you really have a really good relationship, you really have some love there, you don't need to shout, just sweet little whispers. I love you, darling. You're really great. You never have to shout, I love you, darling! You're the most wonderful guy in the whole world! No one ever shouts that, do they? They're sort of like, oh, you're so wonderful, you're so lovely. So psychologically, you're actually, you know, believing you're distant. That's why you need to shout. So when you're close together, you don't need to shout. So love, living, laughing together. And I see that sometimes. Sometimes people get very upset at me. They get upset at anybody. Even people got upset at the Buddha and tried to assassinate him. So we know we all have our, you know, our enemies. And sometimes I try to break the ice by telling a joke. And I remember visiting one monk. He didn't like me because of I did the bhikkhuni ordination. I told him a joke and he just stood there. Like a robot. You know, robots don't laugh. It's not actually, they don't know the software, the program for laughter. Because laughter is a bit idiotic. And so you have to have artificial stupidity programmed into a computer, not artificial intelligence, to be able to laugh. Only human beings can do that. But he was so upset at me, he just couldn't laugh at all. You have to have that love, that connection. And also to be able to laugh at life. You have to love life to laugh at it. That's why a little bit of laughter, it's not just the best medicine for your body, emotional medicine is great. Which is one of the reasons that one of the deepest meditation teachings I was ever given. People come here to meditate. They want to learn meditation, and some people drive me crazy. They want to do the real meditation. None of this opening the door of your heart. I'm going to sit down here. None of these namby-pamby cushions. No chairs. We're going to sit down real tough, like US Marines boot camp meditation retreats. Sit down and don't move. And the master comes with a big stick. And if you move slightly, whack on your back. Out of compassion, of course. I can't understand how that's compassion. That's just the excuse. And they think that that is a really good teaching. That doesn't work. I've been teaching meditation 50 years almost now. Actually, when I was 45 years or something like that. Anyway, a long time. So I know what I'm talking about, and I'm well respected as a teacher. I've got loads of disciples. It works, this method. And one of the best teachings I got as a young student, the best meditation teaching ever, was my teacher at that time told me I wasn't smiling enough. Wasn't happy. My posture, not the way I folded my legs, not whether my back was straight, not where I put my hands, but how I put my mouth. Wasn't smiling enough. So I had to do some remedial training. My teacher said, when you first get up in the morning, what do? Go to the toilet. Is that what you do as well? Of course, you've been in bed for such an hour, so you've got to let go. So he said, after you've done some letting go, then, is there a mirror in your bathroom? I said, yeah, of course there is. So he said, I want you to look at yourself in the mirror and smile at yourself. And at that, I was a student, I was still drinking alcohol, partying late at night with your friends and your girlfriends. And I said, look, when I first get up in the morning, if I had the courage to look at myself in the mirror, I'd be so terrified of what I might see. You know, those of you who are married, if you looked at your wife early in the morning, looked at your husband when he's still drooling, it's not a nice sight, is it? So I said, look, I don't look that good in the morning. Okay, just another little story. Cambridge University in the 60s, 70s. So formal. English, okay. This is English upper class. There's some lords in that university. You know, counts and all sorts of weird people. And, of course, it was all male college. In theory. And the practice was, you had your girlfriends, you know, overnight. You know, not every night, but on the weekend. You know, we were boys, young people, 60s, you know, liberation or whatever it was, and hippies and stuff. But anyway, so the students, we did a petition to the dons, the big professors, the really stuffy old academics, saying, can we have permission for our girlfriends to come to breakfast? Because they were hungry. We didn't say permission for they could sleep overnight, because, you know, that was pushing things too far. But they all knew, you know, why do you have to have your girlfriends for breakfast if they, you know, weren't overnight? So they put that in. And the response came from the committee of dons, the professors, to say, we considered your request, but we decided to reject it on the grounds that gentlemen do not appear their best in the early morning. And they were calling me a gentleman. Come on. That was so English, you know, you don't appear your best in the morning, so ladies should not come into the breakfast room. But there's some truth behind that. If I looked in the mirror, I didn't appear my best. So I said, I cannot do that. And he said, do it. And he said, if you can't manage a natural smile, this is where I got my teaching. You put your two fingers on either side of the mouth. Looking in the mirror and push up. This is humoristic Buddhism, the heart of it. You may think that's stupid, that that's a joke. That was one of the most powerful therapies I ever had. And I followed that for 2 years. I don't think I missed a morning. It became part of my routine. Go to the toilet, now wash your hands, look in the mirror. Heard this stupid young student. Early in the morning, tired, maybe a bit of a hangover sometimes. I admit that, you know, it took me a while to give up alcohol. And you had to use your fingers, because what I saw was not pleasant. pushed up, and I saw this really ridiculous, stupid young man making a face in the mirror. And the result of that was I laughed. And the guy in the mirror laughed. And I don't know if people probably thought I'd been taking drugs, or was still on the alcohol early in the morning, hadn't gone to bed yet. How can you laugh like that? Every morning I did that for 2 years, laughing at myself in the mirror. The therapeutical value of that is enormous. Starting the day off with a really positive mind, laughing and getting the body awake, that's much better than having a cup of coffee in the morning. Have a laugh at yourself in the morning. You go out, no matter what happened the night before, positive mind, ready to start the day with a very open heart. Because laughter opens up your heart. That's why I gave quite a couple of talks, I don't know why these days, but in the hospitals over in Hong Kong, and even in the health authority, the bosses of the medical authority in Hong Kong, and Queen Mary Hospital, it's quite a few places. Anyway, it was at Prince Charles Hospital, well, one of those royalty, they're all the same anyway. I don't know why they always name hospitals after royalty, or after saints. Why can't they, name it after, drug addicts, because they supply most of the patients. Or anyway, that in this hospital, it's interesting if you actually go there, who actually deserves the name of hospital. Why does it always be saints? They died a long time ago. They didn't survive. They're not healthy anymore. But anyway, where's they going on this? It was really quite hard for them to get like a Buddhist monk into these hospitals to give talks, because they say, no, if we have a Buddhist, we have to have an Anglican and a Catholic and a Muslim and a Taoist, and for being fair. And so I told them, I said, no, don't introduce me as Buddhist monk Ajahn Brahm. Call me Dr. Brahm. The heart surgeon. He said, you're not a heart surgeon. Yes, I am. I open the door of people's hearts. So that qualifies me as being a heart surgeon. In fact, I did write a best-selling book on heart surgery, Opening the Door of Your Heart. Unlike other heart surgeons who close up the heart after they've done the operation, I always leave your heart open after you've done surgery. So I qualify as a heart surgeon. Now, even mentioned, somebody, a disciple, a friend over in Adelaide told me this. They went into the big bookshop looking for my book to buy it. And they were looking and looking, and they couldn't find it, in the spiritual section. This is an old joke, but this is a great one. About the person who went to look for one of my books and said they thought it would be in the self-help section. So they went up to the counter of the bookshop and they say, where is the section on self-help books? And the person behind the counter said, if I told you, it would defeat the purpose. Self-help, find it for yourself. So, there we go, the guy sort of looking for the book, and they eventually found it. It was in the medical section. So somebody saw it, opened the door of the heart, and they thought it was heart surgery, so they bunged it in the medical section. True story. I was very proud of that. So if you look in the bookshop, you can't find my book, then maybe look in the medical section, might find it in there. But anyway, you can see what I'm talking about here. That what is the purpose of coming to a place like this? You're getting some information, but information which works, which lessens suffering in your life, which makes you see things in a different way, which looks at anxiety, which looks at fear, which looks at the places where fear lives, in places like funerals, in dementia, if you're anxious at having cancer. Oh, I love going to the cancer groups and making everybody laugh. really good for their health, and teaching them how to use spirituality. The spirit, be inspired, be uplifted, being sort of opened. That is what real Buddhism, Christianity, Islam should really be. Inspiring people, letting them see life in a different way, not in a negative way, but highly positive. So yeah, that's why tonight's talk, you can give it that title, not humanistic Buddhism, but humoristic Buddhism. The Buddhism for the 21st century. Thank you for listening, and thank you most of all for laughing. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, so we got any questions from overseas or any complaints? Probably from the Pope about that joke about Easter. I'm doing a Jesus, the wife is doing a Mary. Anyway, see what questions we have here this evening. Okie dokie, here we go, the first question. Oh, we didn't actually say from USA, USA and something, Tim. How can one change a character trait that one carries from life to life? Easy. Listen to these YouTube talks. People often come up to me and, you know, so many times, just even in the aircraft, in the lounges, just walking down the street, even that was at last... last October. I was in London. No, not London, actually Brighton. Somebody invited me to the seaside town of Brighton in England. And after lunch, just walking for exercise, just, you know, it was a very beautiful day, just, you know, on the seafront. And a couple of people came across and they said, "You Ajahn Brahm, you're supposed to be in Perth. We were going to tune in this evening for YouTube. What are you doing here?" And I said, well, you know, I've got to be somewhere. I just happen to be here to sit today. But anyway, they said that they, like many people, they watch these YouTubes and change their life. And I said, for the better or for the worse? They say, for the better. Thank goodness for that. So these talks actually do change your life. Hanging out with positive people changes your life. Meditating changes your life. You're changing your character traits. That's how you change them. Yeah, you carry something from your past life to this life, but during this life, this is where you can refine them. That's what this life is all about, to learn, to refine, to open your heart. From the USA, first of all, how can we introduce laughter and humor into conversation with loved ones without being misunderstood as being insensitive to their losses? Sometimes that's a tough one, but if you can get a couple of people on side to laugh as well, so you outnumber those people in the family who are insensitive, then they can't resist it after a while. Because laughter is very hard to resist. Once people start, nearly everybody joins in. And sometimes people start laughing and they don't even know what the joke is. Honestly, this happens to me. But sometimes when you go overseas, like to Hong Kong, they say I speak very fast, you know, because, you know, English is the second language. And everybody laughs when I tell the joke. And then they say, actually, no, I didn't understand it. They still laugh anyway. You can't resist it, even if you don't understand it. So sometimes you get a few people, you know, professional laughers, into with your family, and then sometimes the humour gets infectious. And of course, once one person sees how pleasant and useful and how it is an answer, a very deep answer. It's not superficial. It's much deeper than that. Just because you understand it doesn't mean it's profound. Laughter is incredibly profound. And that's why many of the people that are the most greatest comedians are very, very intelligent, very sharp. So, being incentive, obviously you've got to find time and place, but a lot of times you can just introduce it with a few friends and then people really get it. Next question, how can you meditate when you're imperfect? For example, I feel when I'm healthy in body and mind I can sit effectively, but when the opposite is the case, I fail. You meditate because you're imperfect. If you are perfect, you don't need to meditate. You're happy, you're peaceful, you're perfect. But, told this again, I've seen this, I saw this in here in Perth. You also get much more wisdom from t-shirts than you ever get in books. You know, somebody should write a book, The Wisdom from T-Shirts. Because one of my favourite t-shirts, which I sell here in Perth, started out the first line, nobody is perfect. You know, that's the truth, isn't it? Nobody is perfect. And the second line of the t-shirt was, I am a nobody. And the third line was the logic, therefore I'm perfect. Nobody is perfect. I am a nobody, therefore I'm perfect. So stop trying to be a somebody, because then you can't say that you're perfect anymore. That's great logic, I like that. So, if you are not healthy in body and mind, the healthy in body you can't do much about, sickness, weakness. So you don't sit meditation, you lie in a bed and meditate. And you can't control your mind. When somebody asked me this a long time ago, they said, well, I can't sit down. So, well, lay down. Well, I can't follow my breath. That is not meditation, following your breath. I asked them, can you make peace in this moment? Can you make peace with your body and your stupid mind instead of fighting a war with it? I said, yeah, I can make peace. Can you be kind? You can always care. Kindness, you can't always cure things, you can't change things, you can't change other people. But you can always care for them. Kindness is a choice which is always available to you. And can you be gentle? And they said yes to those three questions. That is the heart of meditation. It's not what you are aware of. It's how you respond to whatever you're aware of. Do you respond with trying to change it, trying to get somewhere, trying to be different than who you are, trying to get rid of your stupid mind, trying to get rid of your sleepiness? If you think that's meditation, you're going to suffer. If you learn how to make peace with whatever you have right now, you know, quite honestly, that when I started meditating this evening, I was exhausted. I've had a really long day traveling overseas, coming back, no, 2:45 this afternoon. Really tired. And after a busy, busy time, I don't go Hong Kong for holiday. I really work hard. And I'm old as well. So, I've got a good excuse to be tired. So, but I made peace with my tiredness. I was kind to it. Beautiful kindness. And so, so gentle. Had a wonderful meditation. So, if you can make peace, if you can be kind, if you can be gentle, that is called meditation. It's not what you're aware of, it's whether you can make peace with it, whether you can be kind to it, whether you are gentle. And for those Buddhists who know their scriptures, that is a second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. To me, probably the most important. Sammasankappa. Okay, so is there any questions from Nolamara in Perth instead of from overseas? If there's not, how to deal with anxiety? Laugh at it. Anxiety. I told this to someone a few weeks ago that somebody, they come here and they hadn't had much anxiety. They managed to sort of overcome it and then they had a big attack of anxiety. How can we deal with that? I said, oh, whenever you're anxious, you say, oh, anxiety, thank you for coming to visit me again. I've missed you. For a couple of months, I haven't been anxious at all. Where have you been? I've missed you. You make peace with anxiety. You're kind to it. You're gentle. You don't try and get rid of it. You open the door of your heart to it. seems to be counterintuitive, but it works. You're not being anxious or being anxious. You're letting it be. Where it comes from, I don't know, but it's come. Here it is. Calm anxiety. I'm going to be anxious. Somebody asked me a similar question, how do you get rid of anger? And I remembered one of Ajahn Chah's methods. He said, next time you're angry, the same will work with anxiety. Sit down, put a clock like this in front of you, check the time, and see how long you'll be angry for. See if you can beat your record. Put it down. Okay, 8:57, I'm going to get really angry now. See how much. Because when you externalize it, it's not you. You don't get sucked into it. Somehow you can separate yourself from it to see how long I'm going to be angry for. See how long anxiety lasts. You're separating yourself from it. You're standing back to see it's just the nature of the mind, sometimes be anxious. But also you're remembering this too will pass because you've got a clock. You know it passes. So that really weakens the grip of anxiety over you. A couple of very easy methods. Okie dokie, so thank you for reminding me of that. That was supposed to be the subject of the talk, but I just got into, you know, all sorts of other silly stuff, but I hope you enjoyed it. Anyway, now we can pay respect to the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, and then we can go and do what we need to do. You obviously haven't got any questions, so I don't expect anybody to be lined up afterwards asking questions. Never happens.